Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:33 a.m., April 4th, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgemond, Co-Chair Newman, and Co-Chair Thompson. Others will be joining us here shortly. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices in the room, including mine. We're going to continue with House Bill 247. And today we're going to hear from industry. We have Fury, we have Great Bear, we have Bluecrest, and we have Aetna. Doyon was originally going to testify, but they all have the flu, so they aren't going to be here today to testify. We'll begin with Fury Operating Alaska. Here to present to the committee are Mr. Bruce Webb, Fury Vice President, and Mr. David Elder, the Chief Finance Officer. Gentlemen, if you'll, during your testimony, if you're going to both talk, if you would each identify yourselves again each time you speak so that the secretary can have it in the record correctly, please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and we'll hear your presentation. Representative Munoz has joined us. And Representative Guerra. Go right ahead.
My name is Bruce Webb. I'm the Senior Vice President of Fury Operating Alaska.
And my name is David Elder. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Fury Operating Alaska.
And Fury would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of the House Finance Committee. As a little bit of a background, Fury came to Alaska in 2011. We brought the first jackup rig to the Cook Inlet. And last year, we set the first platform in about two decades out in the Cook Inlet. And we began producing natural gas in November of last year. Throughout the process, we've been supported by German investments. And we go to those investors and explain to them the state tax credit program. And they've viewed this as the state partnering with Fury Operating Alaska. And it's enabled us to raise a significant amount of capital, which without that, we would not have been able to do the project that we did last year. Turn it over to David.
One thing we see is the tax.
We're having David Elder speak now.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Try to remember that. We look at the tax credits as extremely vital. Not only to our business, but to the citizens of the state of Alaska. They create jobs. They support investment in the state. The investment creates jobs, brings revenue to the state. We've invested over $700 million. And just to give you an idea of the scope, we have 11 full-time employees. We're a small company. And we feel that we've done exactly what the tax credits were designed to do. We took great risk. A lot of small investors in a small company came into the Cook Inlet. No one had drilled there since the 90s. We brought the first jackup rig since the 90s. And we've installed last year 15 miles of subsea pipeline. We built an onshore gas processing facility. And we installed an offshore platform. We signed our first contracts, and I think as you go through and you look at the evidence, we've helped lower the price of gas to the citizens of southeastern Alaska. So we see a lot of benefits from these tax credits, and we think that when you look at it, you look at the return that we intend to give to the state, to the people of the state. You know, the examples are we employed over 300 people this summer here in Alaska at the peak of the project. We've invested all the tax credits we've received in the infrastructure, in the drilling, and in the development process. We haven't taken the tax credits and done anything other than reinvest them in the state. Without continued support through the tax credit program, then we're going to have to cut back significantly on the development and exploration of the lease acreage we have.
Representative Gaddis has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you misspoke or not, but you said southeast, and I know your partner knew better.
He knew better.
I'm not sure if you're from Alaska or whatever, but south central is what I think you meant, correct?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, that's correct. Now, I'm going to be coming up here and moving my operations, so I'll learn a little more. But I come back and forth between Texas right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a difference, and we love our neighbors from southeast, but certainly the Cook Inlet is not in southeast, so thank you.
Apologies again.
Continue, Mr. Elder.
As we said before, the tax credits are key to supporting the development in the state. We've read now the proposed legislation that's come out from the Natural Resource Committee, and we'd point out a couple of things there. You know, we do long lead time projects. The well that we've brought online and the additional wells we'll drill this year, we started that process in 2013. It took us 2014 and 2015 just to install the infrastructure. We have two additional wells that we have to put in this year. So by having, you know, by having certainty, which is what we need to do our business, then that enables us to complete a project that we relied upon tax credits in terms of economics as well. We also want people to understand that in a small company, unlike the large companies, these are important to our overall financing. We've had to borrow a significant amount of money to complete this project. And so the tax credits over the time horizon that we've had them are significant to repay our lenders. So again, we're asking for certainty in the process. We want to be able to plan out our investment, raise our funding, and know that, you know, that what we've relied upon will be there and paid so we can service all of the constituents we have, our investors, our lenders, and our employees and our customers. So we would like you to consider that. We also want to say that this has been an investment by the state in developing its natural resources. Our company will begin repaying that investment now. During the early years, you know, we've had people tell us we've done exactly what the program was intended to do. Based on this, we were a small company. We could move quickly. We took on a significant amount of risk in doing this. But now, through the tax credits, that enables to take that risk on, and now we're ready to begin paying back the state. And just give you a few examples. As I've said, we employed over 300 people directly in this project. We helped bring back the Nikiski and Kenai area into, because we were one of the pioneers coming back in. The service companies rely upon us. The you know, everything from housing, lodging. We used over 100 local suppliers in the Alaska area as we went through this project, and we'll continue to do so. And that ranges from the local, the local service companies, part of the international family that they belong to, down to just local vendors and suppliers. In terms of property taxes, here's another example. From 2012 to 2015, we paid $2.9 million in property taxes. Starting this year, after this investment, we're going to pay approximately $5 million a year. So the investments will help generate revenue for local communities. We estimate that the royalties that we're going to pay to the state just over the existing reserves that we have to date, without drilling and adding additional reserves, will be $300 million. We also feel like we've helped lower the cost of gas to the area. If you look at the two contracts we've signed now, we've brought prices down from what would have been $8 in 1920 to into the $6.50, $6.73 range on our contracts. We think that the bill that's been recommended to this committee will enable us to continue to meet our objectives. It gives us certainty. Some key things are, as I've said, we're relying upon payment on these tax credits earned in 2015 and 2016. We see the cash purchase limitations in there very helpful to us because we would have certainty in payment. And, you know, we would ask everyone here to consider the impact on the industry, the impact on the jobs in the community, and that many of us have relied on this program to make these investments.
Mr. Elder, we have a couple of questions. Representative Wilson first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you do understand, though, on the payments to you for these tax credits that it is based on appropriation not necessarily being paid in the same year when you made these projects, correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we do understand that, but when we're speaking of years, we're talking about the fiscal year beginning. For example, 2014 tax credits were paid to us in would have been the July 2015 period. So that's what we're asking. We understand that.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
We must have more money then when we paid that. But for now, if we don't have it, you know, you weren't one of the top ones, we're still meeting our obligations even if we don't pay it this year, and it may pay 3 or 4 years out. I mean, I was just trying to make sure that, because there's been a little confusion that we must pay them in the same year. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have the funding, the tax credits still stay good, and you can use them against your own tax liability or wait until, you know, the state, you know, starts to see more profit. So are you saying that you're not going to be able to do the projects unless you get the tax credits cashed in on the year that you submit them?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, what I'm saying is we rely upon a program that was already there. So we need certainty. We have lenders that we've used, you know, have financed this program. What we didn't anticipate was that this extension of payments on the tax credit would begin this year. Our debt is such that it's, you know, begins maturing based on the schedule that we enjoyed previously. So what we're asking you to consider is, if we know with certainty what the future is, we can structure our business to it. To make this change in the middle creates a tremendous amount of risk to us that our lenders will not roll those loans forward. So that's what we're asking.
And follow up?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you for the latitude, because I just want to make sure, to me this is really important. But we didn't change the rules, is what I guess I'm getting to, is that as we've had money, we've been able to pay them as they've been turned in, which is great because we saw high oil prices. You know, I'm from the interior, just so you know, so I'm not reaping any of these benefits you're talking about and have not for a long time. But the game hasn't changed at this point because the statute says that there's a certain amount that it's around $70 million for this year, and that they would be rolled into year after year and until those could be in. So, you know, you're talking about us changing the game, and I guess, you know, we're not changing anything at this point. It's just, you know, we've been able to pay right away. Now we can't, but that doesn't change anything that's actually been part of the plan.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I point back that we looked at a program and the way it has worked. We always understood to some extent that that was a risk, but, you know, we relied upon how it was in practice, what had been done previously, and again, if we were going to make this change, had we known it last year, we could have structured our business accordingly. It's hard in midstream when you're a company our size to have this kind of change. You know, going forward, if we know how it works, then it's not a problem to us. But again, we've done this since 2012, and the practice has been to pay those credits as they were earned.
And one more follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
Out of due respect, if we knew oil was going to drop like it did, we'd do a lot of things differently as well. I just want one other subject is that I know you know about SB 21 and look at the North Slope and how much they pay in taxes and all the rest. So, you know, as we look at Cook Inlet and see that they don't, you know, pretty much they haven't paid any taxes to benefit the whole state versus property taxes for the community, this is probably not I probably shouldn't. I'm going to do this anyway. So don't you think that it's time for those in Cook Inlet to pay their fair share as far as taxes go, and so that we're not continuously looking at just the North Slope producers?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'm not as familiar with the North Slope tax structure, but, you know, I think as you look at the Cook Inlet, again, I think you have to differentiate between the size and what stage of development a company is in versus those that are much larger than us and have a lot more base already producing. You've had a lot of consolidation in the Cook Inlet region. And again, you know, at this stage in our development, we anticipate that we will begin paying taxes here in a few years. If nothing, you know, the LCF credit, which is we viewed as essentially a subsidy while we developed, you know, our production and began selling our product, that will begin phasing out for us rather quickly.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the latitude.
Forgot to note, about 15 minutes ago, we were joined by Vice Chair Sadler and Representative Pruitt. Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to follow up on Representative Wilson's question.
Pull your mic down, please.
We appreciate you being up here. The benefit of what you do and the explorers in Cook Inlet, at least the ones that don't export our gas, you're supplying gas to South Central. So we understand that that's important, and we're trying to draw balance in a year when we have a $4.4 billion deficit. So, first of all, I've got to say, when I voted for this tax credit legislation, I thought that the money we were going to give would help you buy equipment so that you could go ahead and drill. But now it's come to light that much of the money that we give goes to pay very high interest rates. What interest rates are our tax credits helping to fund? What are the level of those interest rates? 5, 10, 15, 20%?
Representative Garrett, through the chair. Number one, the money isn't going to pay the debt service. What it's done is enable us to take the tax credits and make them liquid, in other words, pull money forward to us. In terms of interest rates, when we first started looking at helping to finance this project in 2012, 2013, the only participants were essentially hedge funds, you know, the more high-risk, high-yield debt funds. We were, at that point, people approached us, and it would have cost us in the neighborhood of 18 to 20% annually to finance the tax credits. Changes that were made in the legislature to allow essentially the assignment of the tax credits and the proceeds paid to the lender brought our cost down to 8% or less annually. Now what we're seeing is people have pulled back from the market. We can't, you know, people don't want to lend. The people who are coming in and saying to us, hey, we'll finance you, are back in the 18% range, which, again, is not very attractive to us. It takes money away that we'd otherwise invest.
To the chair, let me.
We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. We do have a full committee now. Representative Guerra, go ahead.
I'd like to ask some follow-ups on that, but I know time is short. When you applied for the tax credits, you're a sophisticated company, I take it. You look at all of the contractual terms, all of the statutory terms, and this is a follow-up to Representative Wilson's question. One of those statutory terms is when the state does not have a lot of money. The amount that we're required to pay in tax credits is a percentage of the production tax revenue that we get in. We used to get $5, $6 billion in production taxes in the state. In these next few years, those production taxes aren't going to be $5 or $6 billion. They're going to be $19 million in 2019. And this year, $50 million. They're falling. So when you applied for the financing and went ahead with this project, I take it you knew about the statute that said we only, in times of tight money, you shouldn't expect that we're going to pay more than what the statute says, which under my understanding of this year's formula would be about not $800 million in tax credits, but $72 million, which means everybody's not going to get paid this year. I take it you knew about that and relayed that to your financiers?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, again, we always understood that there was appropriations risk again, I don't think anybody anticipated oil prices crashing as much as they did. And, you know, I understand, you know, we all have families, we all have budgets. I understand the responsibility that all of you have to your constituents and to the state. But again, all we're asking for is transition. I recognize that, you know, the state budget, where it's at. But again, we are just asking for transition. We did rely upon it. We were able to file our tax credits and receive payment within 6 months. That was the history in what we operated under. We didn't anticipate that we would be where we are today, or we would not have borrowed against these, or we would have structured it different. And again, having certainty, being able to meet what our obligations are in the near term, and understanding that these are going to get scaled back, we understand that, and we understand the pressures, and we're looking at our business to see what we can do different to allow us to continue to operate here. It costs, from what we've seen, about 300% more to make an investment in this area than it does in the lower 48. And, you know, again, we want a transition that enables us to meet our obligations. If we know what the future is, we'll only work within those in that realm.
I just want to make sure, though, it's not that we're not honoring our appropriations. We have a statute on the books, and I just want to make sure you had relayed to your lenders the statute on the books that says, I mean, you take risks in your business. We've unfortunately taken a big risk in our state budget, but that's your business. You take risks, and you understood that there's a statute that said if oil prices tanked, we would have to delay tax credit payments because there's a formula that says how much we are required to pay in tax credits. And it's not $800 million that's due. It's this. The formula says for this year about $72 million. You knew about that statute, and you relayed that to your lenders, right?
Mm-hmm. Representative Garrett, through the chair, again, we looked at the practice. We understood that that was a risk. What we didn't contemplate that all of a sudden, in the middle, based on what had been, how we had participated in the program, and how it was paid and how it was administered, was going to change this rapidly. And that's where our dilemma is.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
Totally understand. I sympathize with you that you didn't anticipate it. Neither did we. Mm-hmm. Right. And we have a lot of seniors and children and others we have to respond to, and our developers. So we get that. You mentioned financing, and what is wrong with the governor's proposal that we shift from just cash payments to companies, which I think you understand we're having trouble with given our financial situation, to a financing mechanism where we get you lower interest loans than you're getting in the market right now? What is wrong with that? And I'd ask you to look at that from our perspective, where whether members around this committee agree or disagree, none of us like the fact that there are cuts to people who are on the edge of being able to move forward with their lives the way they are right now. We are in a very tight budget situation. So with that, what is wrong with what are your views on the governor's proposal that we start helping productively a way to help finance this development but not pay cash so that we get the money back eventually?
Representative Garrett, through the chair. The governor's proposal, first of all, you know, and we're in a transition period. There are things that waste the structure. In other words, if the investment was made in a fund, you know, the $25 million just isn't, that's not going to benefit us that much. The cost of capital, and our capital program will slow, but please keep in mind that we spent over $300+ million in the last 2 years. In terms, I believe there are some ways that type of program could help, but I think it's more in terms of structuring a fund where those of us who could approach based on the tax credits that we've earned and financed through that fund, but $25 million wouldn't be enough. And then if you had a structured payment, you know, we knew what period of time, then those payments would go to retire our obligations to the fund.
Just one final question.
Representative Garrett.
And you did mention that when you when this field comes in production, you'll be paying taxes. And I just want you to want your view on this. You won't really be paying production taxes. Our production tax in Cook Inlet is essentially zero. You will be paying a royalty of roughly 12.5%, depending what the contract is on your field. You won't be paying production taxes. And I guess, let me ask you this, do you think that that's fair, and whether with all of the upfront investment the state is putting into your company, it's fair to then, when you come into production, not have any production taxes to pay?
This is Bruce Webb, Representative Guerra, through the chair. Cook Inlet's pretty unique. It's not like the North Slope. In 2014, the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce did a report on what the benefits of oil and gas were to the Cook Inlet region. And it's more than just production tax. It's about $2.5 billion a year, because Anchorage is the economic hub of the state. Everything goes in and out of Anchorage. All of the oil that's produced in the Cook Inlet is converted into diesel fuel and jet fuel, which supports the Port of Anchorage, the International Airport, the military base. All the natural gas is used locally. So even though the companies in the Cook Inlet don't pay production taxes, they do pay royalties, the benefits of that production are greatly higher than what the production tax of that small amount of production would be to the state. So there is a little bit of a trade. It's not a direct tax payment to the state, but it does create income and fosters development and other types of income to the state.
Representative Guerra.
And I won't make this comment again, but the one thing that you miss, I think, and I'm an Anchorage guy.
Mm-hmm.
I would love my constituents in Anchorage to get the best deal possible. But when we don't impose a production tax in Cook Inlet, that may or may not have some benefit for our constituents in Anchorage, but the people who pay for that are the people who don't get the revenue in other parts of the state. So that Anchorage gas doesn't go to southwest Alaska. It doesn't, in large part, go to interior Alaska. It doesn't go to southeast Alaska. So essentially what we're asking is for that benefit to come to folks in one region, but at the expense of people in other regions.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. Next, we have Representative Guttenberg with question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm a non-Anchorage legislator also. But I appreciate your comment about transition. I'm sure we all have a different definition of what we perceive as transition. All of us, the industry and the state, and, you know, you listen to news about what's happening to energy-dependent states around the country and around the world, you know, on the impact of the price of oil is significant everywhere. You know, and when you change your corporate business plan to do things that are going to change, you affect everybody downstream as well. It's the same thing from the state. Everybody's affected. I mean, we don't have a choice. Our businesses, you know, never mind. I mean, Representative Guerra went on about, children and seniors. That's specific. And we have some proposals on the table that are asking Alaskans to write checks, you know, to pay for state services. And it's not really going to be acceptable if they know they're writing a check and hundreds of millions of dollars a year are going right out the other side of the building to write checks for people without being able to understand the direct economic impact of what the credits are doing. So we have a problem understanding what Fury gets, what it directly turns over, what those credits actually do, and whether or not direct cash payments are better than loans. Because if you go anyplace else, all your lenders get something back for it. The state gets back economic activity, but that happens anyway. So You know, and we want you here, and we want the exploration and the development. That's a part of who we are. It's going to be that way for a long time. But being able to understand exactly what the credits do with your business plan, is there a way that the confidentiality agreements would not be onerous for you, so that we could understand how much you get, what it turns around and produces, so that we can weigh the value of that?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I think I have some current concerns on disclosing the confidential information. That I really do. I don't know that. I'm not sure what's gained. I do know in our case that I don't feel it will help us do the things we need to do in continuing to raise capital in there. I would say, again, on the financing proposal as it's put forward, it really doesn't help us transition out of this. It's not, for a company our size, it's not probably large enough to at least meet what we've already done. Going forward, you know, our capital spending going forward, we're looking at doing, you know, we were originally looking at doing about $500 million of additional investment over the next 3 to 5 years. Given where we understand where the state is, we understand that. And I, you know, we're not, again, looking, we understand the constraints. We're not asking, we don't want to see, but we cannot be in a position where we can't transition out. We also create jobs, and that's not going to help the state if those jobs aren't there. You know, you ask what benefits back to the state. I would again point to the natural gas prices that you're seeing now as a result of us bringing on significant additional reserves. I think that, you know, that one of the dangers of at least taking these incentives from smaller companies like us is that you're going to have more of a monopoly situation, and you're not going to see the additional resources developed. And so when these contracts are renewed with the utility companies, they're going to be at much higher rates. You know, when we first came here and I talked to people in the state, one thing they pointed out to us, you know, is that the special IDC credit, essentially the 40% rate versus 20% on other credits, was designed to bring small independents into the state. The larger companies didn't, you haven't seen them invest in the Cook Inlet. Even though, you know, we believe there are significant reserves, they pulled away. They look for dinosaur fields. And as opposed to us, we're looking to realize on what resources we still see that are there. So we, you know, again, we're asking for transition. You know, we're asking a chance to restructure in terms of trying to finance these so the people of the state get the benefit. We're more than happy to sit down with people. I've been a finance guy, corporate finance, for 30 years. And I had at one time talked to some of the people in the Department of Revenue and said, hey, you know, I've got some ideas you might want to look at. But they're not going to come about quick enough for us to make that transition. And that's all we're really asking. And again, we see them scaling down. We understand the reasons, but we still have to honor, you know, obligations we met. And we understood there was appropriations risk. But again, we looked on practice. We had no reason to believe at that time. And remember, we're structuring this stuff 2 years out. It's not something we just did. So again, that's where our concern is right now.
Just a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Gutenberg.
Thank you. So I'm sure you don't have any investors that don't want to know what they're getting for the money or what the rate or the return is or what the risk is. The state which wants to know in a very similar vein, what specifically, how much we're giving you, because we don't know how much, you know, and this is, although the industry might call this a tax, this is like a grant, you know. Mm-hmm. We just write you a check. You do work, we write you a check. No place, we're like the grants administrator. What is the value of writing the check to you? What have we gotten for it? Because believe me, there's a lot of people in this state that don't feel any economic impact from what you're doing. I mean, we appreciate you being here. We appreciate the continued work being done in Cook Inlet. But it only goes so far. And there's a lot of people out there because has a minimal effect for the people of my district. I mean, everybody appreciates that it's being done on, and we're looking for gas. And where that is still questionable. Where that's coming from is still questionable. But like, just call us a grants administrator. What's the value of what we're doing? That's a problem that we have. You know, there's plenty of people doing it. And in the backdrop of that, the price has crashed. I mean, it's beyond a crash. You know, I'm sure you, in some places you're restructuring your business portfolio and your work schedule. But getting back to transition, how do you define transition? How do you see, you know, the bill defines it and how it's doing, and there's two different versions so far. But how do you define transition out? Just paying this down over a few more years, or continuing the project on and keeping the credits on the books for a few more years with limits on it, with caps? How, if I may ask that question, how do you define transition?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I think in the governor's legislation, they talked about a July 1 effective date. From our company's standpoint, we're asking that any changes at least not go into effect until January 1 of next year. You know, we're going to be in the middle of operations. As I said, our capital plan was put into place, you know, a couple of years ago. So this is probably the most significant development that's been done in the Cook Inlet and for our company, and we want to be able to finish that up under the rules we were operating on. The payment area is, again, from being the chief financial officer, is my biggest concern. I'm not concerned about, you know, again, if we look at credits being earned this year, and we know how they're going to be paid out, if they're going to be paid out over 1 or 2 years, we can structure into that. The problem is we relied upon this, and we've structured our existing financing based on a practice that had been in place, and, you know, that had enabled us to speed the development along and to ensure that we had the capital to complete it. So that's where my concern is what are we going to do about 15, 16? Again, if I know the rules, you know, in advance and how it's going to be done, I can structure to it. It's hard for us to change midstream.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Webb, Mr. Elder, looking back, you know, there was a shortage of supply, not in the ground, but just for natural gas to keep the financial center of our state, Anchorage, moving. So these credits and exploration credits and incentives were put in place, and they worked. We now have a supply. Not too long back, we were a market looking for gas, and it's approaching the time where now we're starting to have some gas looking for a market. Through that process, with the price crash of oil and revenue that comes into the state because of that, the state of Alaska is a big business, no different than yours or anybody else's, and we're trying to stop the bleeding. We're trying to figure out how to get through this the same as everybody without hurting people that have already got commitments that we had basically been involved with. So I hope you can understand what we're trying to do. We need to put on our brakes right now because our future and net operating losses carrying forward could keep us broke for many years, even after recovery, because of the amount of credits we'd have. So that's what we're trying to figure out and work with and try to get to. So bear with us. You might not like us when we get done, but we're going to try. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Sheriff. Good morning, Mr. Ellers. What is your lease rate? Just curious, what is the lease rate? What is your royalty rate in your leases? Pardon me.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, 12.5% on the bulk of it.
Great.
We did get a discovery royalty on the one lease, so that one lease would be of 5% relative to the rate. The rest of it's 12.5%.
Good deal. Given the current loans that you've told us about in the current stage of your development, and you mentioned your original plans to invest about another $500 million, what would the tax credit regime in the House Resources CS version, the most recent version of the bill, what would that enable you to do going forward?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it would enable us to complete this development and meet our obligations with the structure that's being proposed. Maybe we have to cut back a little bit. Maybe we can't do $500 million, but I can see us being able to do $250 in the next 3 years.
Okay. And what does, just looking ahead, what does the prospect of the tax holiday in Cook Inlet ending in 2022 mean for your business plans to operate in Alaska?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, again, that's enough time for us to plan. And the one thing I want to point out, and number one, to those not benefiting directly, we are looking at some technology. We just signed a confidentiality agreement the other day to look at some ways to bring gas to the interior and other things. There is some new technology besides LNG, although we've worked with a number of LNG plants. But to answer the question, you know, the way the utility market was structured, when the contracts were locked up upon the sale of the other assets, I mean, at the time, and there were brownouts and other reasons, there were good reasons to do it, but the contract structure of the utility market was closed at that time. So we were not able to even begin selling gas until this year, and our next contract that takes in effect, which really puts us at the point once we get to the next contract, that we're self-sufficient. We generate enough cash at that point to pay for our business, to pay our investors, our lenders, will be in the 19 time frame. So because of that structure, you know, where we didn't have outlets for that gas, it made it more difficult to raise the capital we had and made it more important that we had that we could rely upon these payments. 2022, we can plan to that. And by then, we expect to have a couple other platforms producing, and we'll have more than enough economy of scale to do that.
Last question, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, again, as the co-chair said, recall the goal of the tax credits and the tax holidays was to incentivize smaller companies like yourself, and appreciate you being here in Alaska, and Hillcorp to come and kind of backfill the majors like Chevron and who had come previously, to backfill them. So from your perspective, how would the tax credit regime envisioned again in the newest CS affect Alaska's reputation in your industry as a place to come and do business, the law notwithstanding, the practice notwithstanding? Overall, what would you tell your colleagues in the industry about Alaska should this pass?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'd tell them it's a great place to do business. They've honored everything that they've said. We relied upon it. We came up here in 2011, and that it's a great place to do business. You've got certainty. You have a supportive environment.
And I invite you, when you do come to Alaska, please come visit Eagle River. Thank you.
Do you have any more presentation?
No, sir.
All right, Mr. Webb, Mr. Elder, thank you very much for being here today and for your presentation. Next, we'll hear from Great Bear Petroleum. Here to present to the committee is Mr. Pat Galvin, Chief Commercial Officer and General Counsel. Mr. Galvin, if you would please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation. And we do have a – give us a moment to get it up on the screen.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Galvin, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pat Galvin. I'm Chief Commercial Officer and General Counsel for Great Bear Petroleum. I welcome the opportunity to come and talk to you about Great Bear, bring you up to speed on what we're doing, but also talk in particular about how tax credits work into our business plan and why they're important to our exploration efforts. So Great Bear, very quickly, we're a North Slope explorer. We were founded in 2010. We're exclusively on the North Slope of Alaska. All of our employees work and live in Anchorage. We hold about 499,000 acres working interest position. We have a footprint with our partners of about 590,000 acres that we operate on. We've so far acquired about 500 square miles of 3D seismic over that area, and we're in the process this winter of acquiring about 450 square miles of additional seismic to cover most of our leasehold. So far we've drilled three exploration wells that I'll talk about in just a moment. As most of you probably know, Great Bear came up primarily focused on the unconventional or shale play. Our first two wells were targeting those to be able to pull whole cores out of those intervals and examine the potential for a shale play on the North Slope. What we've come to realize is that we've got a bit of a catch-22 as it relates to a shale play on the North Slope of Alaska. We need costs to come down in order to make a shale play economic. If you took the Eagle Ford play in Texas, the prolific shale play in that area, and you dropped it on the North Slope, it would not be economic and would not be developed. In order for us to be able to pursue a shale play, we're going to need to bring the economies of scale down. And we really would need the amount of drilling that would be associated with a shale play to do that. And so we're a bit of a chicken and egg situation as it relates to the shale play. The way that we see to break through that is to develop the conventional plays that exist on our acreage. By investing in the 3D seismic, we've been able to identify conventional plays that exist within our acreage, and we can pursue those first, develop infrastructure based upon the economies of a conventional play, and then have a shale play potentially come in after that based on that previous investment in a conventional play. So we've redirected our focus towards conventional. We will likely use unconventional technology to develop that, horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing, in order to increase the production rates. But we see the opportunity as being more of a conventional type play. We still believe that an unconventional play could work in Alaska, but it will probably come on the back of the build-out associated with a conventional play. Great Bear has undergone a significant management team change and an expansion of our staff. We have a completely new management team, brought in a CEO who's drilled wells all around the world. We have a new chief operating officer, new exploration manager, new geology team. We've gone from a year ago, we had 5.5 employees. We're now up to 13, and we're moving quite quickly towards developing our acreage. We didn't get the PowerPoint presentation. I get all of it all at once. It was supposed to build out. Sorry. So our acreage position, just to orient you, is located basically just south of Prudhoe and Kuparuk. We're along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Hall Road that cut right through where you see the wells that were drilled. We're about 15 miles south of Dead Horse, and we have entered into a joint agreement with Halliburton over a portion of our acreage that you see sort of in that northern central part. They are earned into a 25% working interest in that area. We've also, as a result of our acreage position to bring it down under the $500,000 limit, we entered into an agreement with Borealis, now Otto. They're a subsidiary now of Otto Energy, an Australian public company. They've picked up 8 to 10% of our interest across most of our leasehold to bring us under the 500,000 limitation. We've shot seismic, as I mentioned. The 500 square miles that I described earlier were shot over 4 years in that central area that's sort of covered in purple. The area that we're shooting right now, we've completed the western block that you see and have moved over, and the seismic crew is now covering the eastern block, and we're hoping to complete it all before this winter season ends. We drilled the two wells that you see, the A and the M, or the first A, the northern A, the Alcor well, and the Merrick well back in the summer of 2012. We're uniquely situated along the haul road, so we were able to identify some sites that are supported by the Trans-Alaska pipeline infrastructure, so we were able to drill them even in the summer with rig mats. And those wells were, again, targeting the unconventional shale play. We took core samples out in order to study those. Last winter, a year ago, we drilled the Alcade well, which is a conventional exploration well. It's about 3 miles west of the Hall Road, built on an ice pad, supported by an ice road. We were hoping to drill three wells last winter, but due to both a shortened season as well as operational issues, we were only able to finish one. So our immediate work plan is to complete our seismic program this year. We're developing a prospect inventory and ranking those. We plan to execute a multi-year, multi-well exploration program over the next number of winters, and we hope that through this multi-well, multi-year program, we're able to bring the costs down by having enough activity to create the competition that we need in order to bring those high costs down. So I'd like to turn to some of the issues associated with tax credits and the relationship to us as an exploration company. I've heard a lot this session in particular and over the last couple of years in just the public discourse about tax credits, and I'd like to focus in on how they affect our business and how they're used by Great Bear and dispel some of the myths that I hear being spouted. The first being that companies are financed by tax credits, that we just come in and live off of the Alaska tax credits. The second, that exploration companies don't have skin in the game, that we're just coming up here off of the tax credits solely. Another one that I've heard recently is that Alaska could get the same level of exploration with a lower tax credit amount. And then finally, that tax credit payments can be delayed with little effect on exploration activities. So turning to the first one, the idea that the companies are solely financed by the tax credits, the way it actually works for North Slope Explorers, and again, I'm focused solely on North Slope. You heard from Cook Inlet. We're only on the North Slope, and these are not intended to apply across the entire state. But from North Slope company's perspective, we pay the costs of our employee salaries, our oil and gas lease rentals, office rentals, other business expenses that keep our business going. Some of those expenditures related directly to exploration activities are going to be covered by tax credits. We can now borrow against the expectation of those tax credits and basically expand our working capital and increase the level of activity by going ahead and borrowing on that tax credit that's going to be coming in. But at no time do we actually make money off of the tax credits. We have to put money in order to be able to earn the tax credits themselves. So going to the skin in the game. Thus far, over the almost 6 years that Great Bear has been in existence, Great Bear and his partners have spent about $220 million gross. Approximately $140 million of that has been or will be reimbursed by tax credits. That's a combination of the net operating loss credit, which has ranged from 25 up to 45, now down to 35% going forward. Some of our activities have qualified for 40% exploration incentive credits. Some of them have qualified for 30% exploration incentive credits. And those stack on top of the net operating loss credits. So Great Bear and his partners have put in $80 million of equity money. Basically, that's money that our investors and our partners have put in that will not get reimbursed. And just to be clear, that none of our investors have received any money back from the tax credits or from our activities. all this money has just gone one direction. So as a result of having $80 million of ours and our investors' money at stake, we were very deliberate, very prudent in the way that we spend our money. We want to get the biggest bang for our buck. Tax credits do provide tremendous value to the state on the exploration side because they purchase information. They purchase the acquisition of both seismic data as well as the information from the wells. And this is information that becomes immediately available to the state and will eventually become public and available for future explorers who are interested in the area. And this is information that would not be available otherwise. So in talking about how tax credits result in more activity, the important thing to understand is the way that the business decisions are actually made by an exploration company in Alaska. We have a certain amount of equity capital that's available to spend. And being able to borrow against the tax credits allows us to basically multiply that available capital to expand our activity set. Depending upon the amount of credits that we're going to be eligible for, that will determine the multiplier effect on our available capital. And so in this particular example here, the company has $100 million available to spend, and its activities are going to be eligible for a 35% tax credit. They will actually spend $140 million on exploration activities. They will borrow against the 35% tax credit to be able to spend $140 million this winter, for example. And then the bank will get paid back on that 35% tax credit when it becomes paid by the state. So if the state offers a higher tax credit, it's going to get significantly more exploration activity. That's just the way it works from an exploration side. And this is the value that the state was trying to realize when the exploration incentive credit program was put in place. And I guess the other point I would make on this is to understand the role of the tax credit in the exploration process. Exploration is risky. You are not guaranteed in any sense of getting paid back, which means that you cannot borrow in a conventional sense for exploration activity. People won't lend it to you. They will invest with an expectation of returns, but they won't lend it to you because you have no cash flow that you can actually borrow against. And so the state providing these tax credits is taking a piece of that risk aspect of the investment. It's different than lending money to a development project that has reserves that's going to go forward and actually has cash flow expectations at the end of the day. That's a different investment. From the reason why the Exploration Incentive Credit Program was put in place is to recognize that in Alaska, we were not seeing a lot of exploration activity. We were not seeing companies willing to take the risk because of high costs and uncertain return. And so the state wanted to lower that hurdle in order to get more exploration activities. And so we had to buy some of that risk through the Exploration Incentive Credit Program.
Mr. Galvin, Representative Guttenberg, on this point.
Yes, on this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On five, or I guess nine. Thank you. Definitely a strong advocate for exploration activity and doing what we can to increase exploration, because that is the high risk, that is the unknown. You've got two different tax credits offered. So when does, on the wells, I'm focusing on wells, when does an exploration well become a development well? When you go into production, or is it before that?
It would be before that. The way that the Exploration Incentive Credit Program is structured, it kind of has a proxy for determining exploration, and that is if you're more than 3 miles from a pre-existing well, then you would be eligible for the 30% credit. If you're both more than 3 miles from a previous well and more than, I think it's 25 miles from a unit, then you'd be eligible for a 40% credit. And so it's that sort of proxy for exploration. In addition, you have to have the Department of Natural Resources make a determination before you drill that the trap that you are targeting has not been previously penetrated by another well.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. So you have an exploration well. It's a couple miles, or it's 25 miles from an existing well. So that's exploration. When you build a pad around the well and you drill the second well meant for production, is that still considered a exploration well, or is it no longer 25 miles because there's an existing exploration well next to it?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, it would be no longer considered an exploration well. Just for complete clarification, once the previous well is more than a year and a half from when it was spud, then it becomes a pre-existing well.
Okay, thank you.
And so you can't get it after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Continue, Mr. Galvin.
So next, turning to a topic of conversation with regard to a delay or uncertainty with regard to state reimbursement of these credits. A delay in the tax credit is going to have a significant impact on the exploration company because, as I mentioned, we've borrowed against the tax credit and there is a certain expectation of when that's going to be repaid. If that payment is delayed, we're going to incur additional interest payments and we're going to likely see higher interest rates because there's going to be a greater risk assigned to that cash flow coming back. And what that means is, under that multiplier effect that I described, less money is going to end up being used for exploration, and there's just going to be a larger portion of that cost associated with finance payments. And you're going to end up with less actual work and less product coming in the form of exploration information. Uncertainty or surprises is significantly more dangerous as well. And that's because what it does is it chases away those potential lenders. Once they see that they can no longer anticipate when the payments are going to come back, then they become unwilling to lend that money. And what we've seen over a fairly short period of time that was somewhat touched upon by the previous presentation is that as the tax credit financing process began, it started out with fairly expensive money, meaning that it was the private equity groups that came in, saw an opportunity to basically lend money against a fairly good investment, and they made a pretty good killing because they were able to extract a very high interest rate and got a fairly secure debt in return. Over time, we were able to begin to attract commercial lenders and bring that interest rate down significantly. And that's where we're at today. But we're on the precipice of reversing that. If we end up creating an uncertain payment schedule from the state, we're going to chase away those commercial lenders and we're going to be back up to the higher lenders if they will even lend themselves. And that then puts us in a situation where we may not be able to borrow against those tax credits. And that completely changes everything that I've presented so far. Because if you imagine in that scenario, then going back to my previous example, the company has $100 million. They can't borrow anything against it, and so they only spend $100 million. They get reimbursed the 35%, and now they're sitting on $35 million. It may not be enough to drill another well. It's now gone. We're now a year later, and they may decide just to pocket that money and give up on the state because their little bit of investment didn't end up resulting in a success because they didn't have enough opportunities to try to make success. And that's what the state is trying to avoid by having the credit program there in the first place. And so it is a significant detriment to the value to the state of not having a program that can be borrowed against and borrowed against at a low cost. So just stepping back and looking at the experience the state has had, the state has put a significant emphasis in our policy and in our investment in trying to attract new investors to the North Slope. We're looking at a transition from an area that's dominated by a few players into one that we hope to see a significant number of independents such as Great Bear. And those have generally worked, and we are beginning to really see a lot of momentum moving towards a potential wave of new investment, new discoveries, and new production. But within the industry, momentum and sort of a herd mentality is a very dominant force. And if we lose that momentum, if we send a message that those who are here are going to have to slow down significantly, or they're going to have to basically pack it up and wait for another group to come in, that is going to be extremely detrimental to the state. And it will have lost the good work that has been really successful over the past decade or more. And so I encourage you to keep that in mind as you make these difficult decisions in this time right now. So in summary, just want to, again, recognize Great Bear as a very active North Slope explorer. Our investments, because a significant amount of it is our own money, have been very prudent and very directed towards those things that will result in the best exploration information that we can gather and that's available to the state. That risk is reduced, likelihood of success is increased by having more exploration activity. And reducing that exploration risk on the North Slope is a significant state interest. And finally, although it's expiring in a few months, I just want to put in the pitch that the Exploration Incentive Credit Program is a very valuable catalyst for North Slope activity and should be extended as it relates to North Slope. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Galvin? Representative Guttenberg, Representative Wilson will follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Galvin, it's always good to see you. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So one of the things that always drives me crazy is when folks come in front of us, they try to convince us that the entire world hinges on the decisions that we make, right?
And it doesn't.
But in the context of the fiscal situation that the world is facing on prices of oil, where investors around the world are saying, we're holding back on investment right now. There's uncertainty in the price. We don't know how long it's going to stay as low as it is. We don't know when it's going to come back up. We can do better with our money someplace else. And with this bill, in this situation, we're hearing that it's all based upon what we're going to do. The whole world's going to cave in or the stability. But we have, you know, we have an obligation as well, because we're faced with, as if we were a corporation, and we give credits for things we want done on our behalf, and all of a sudden, we don't have the cash anymore. What part of what we're actually doing, I mean, I know we're making this place, as it should be, investor-friendly. But what part of the rest of the investor world is out there saying, we're just slowing down on investments in new production, in exploration, new production stuff. So it's not just us. You go to Wall Street, you know, they say, well, we're not moving that fast on this stuff anymore. And then we're just giving money out, 700 plus million this year, and, you know, that's a part of it. But what part of the activity, I mean, and we're curtailing a lot of activity, But where is the investment world looking at what we're doing? I mean, the question comes up is, how are we going to look if we curtail this program where it is now? What's the investment world going to look at us? I say we're acting prudently. I mean, we want to maintain activity. We want to, I mean, I personally think that some of the exploration incentives should stay in place. But how are we going to be perceived if we don't act prudently as well?
Representative Guttenberg, to the chair. First off, I'd like to distinguish the two decisions that you've kind of put together. When you look at your decision is to make a policy call that establishes a program, and a credit program. You're not looking at individual investment decisions. That's not your role. When you talk about the fact that the level of investment in new development and so forth is going down, to a certain extent, that's the self-correcting aspect of having the credit program the way it is, in the sense that if the investment isn't good, then it won't be made, which won't qualify for a credit and will preserve the state from having to make a payment. And from an exploration standpoint, you have to understand that you want to put exploration dollars in the ground ahead of when you're going to want production. And similar to the state looking at the sort of conveyor belt of activity that it needs in order to have production in the future, you want to make sure that you're keeping activity going at the front end, so that when prices do rebound, we have discoveries that are capable of attracting the investment decisions when they are prudent to be made, and when oil prices have risen to a level where they justify that investment. And so I think that it's somewhat tangential to think that you guys are making an investment decision in exploration when you're setting a policy and you're saying, hey, we're going to set this policy, we're going to say this is the level of contribution the state's willing to give to exploration. You decide whether or not it's then worthwhile to make that investment. If you raise that bar, that exploration cost bar for an explorer, we will choose how much exploration we're going to do given the amount of contribution the state's going to make. So I guess what it gets complicated when you combine the credit programs for ongoing production, the credit programs for development projects, and the credit programs for exploration into one lump and try to discuss them as if they're all the same. And so I'm here to talk about exploration and the economics of exploration, and we can talk about what we expect if we get to a development project and how the state programs would fit into that. But there isn't the ability of the industry to react to the prices is one of the things that helps the state and the credit program from getting overexposed at certain times.
I may, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you separated exploration from development and production, and because my impression is you go to look for a loan for exploration. Most people are like, we don't do exploration. Too risky, right? So the state fronts credits or gives credits. I think that's what we should be doing, wherever it is. Certainly the frontier basin where it's less money, and that's another story. But you do exploration, you do your seismic work, and then you have prospects. Then you go back and you say, we found it. You know, and the chances of getting investors from someplace else go up. Then you get investments to drill a couple of wells, and you say, we really found it, or we didn't, right? I mean, there's a point the state's got a lot of money and risk on there. But then you found it, you have some production wells, and you go back and you say, we found it, and we know what the volume is, and we know what the quantity is, and we think we have an idea. Should the state be involved in it at that point? I mean, it seems like at that point, credits should become loans because there's a return not just on taxes and royalties, but at that point the high risk is a moderate risk. You know, should it change into a loan program, or should it, you know, isn't that in the state's best interest?
I think there are positive and negative things that, to be discussed about either a credit program or a loan program. When you get into a loan program, you're getting the state in a different position as it relates to the decision-making of the companies, and it complicates things. The credit program was intended to always be, to a certain extent, the state saying, hey, we're going to set the bar here. You decide, private industry. You're in a better position to decide whether or not your project clears or doesn't clear that hurdle given the contribution the state's willing to make. I think that the state currently isn't structured to be a co-investor yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was mingling the former commissioner's role and his current role together. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. welcome, Mr. Galvin. Did I cut somebody, Mr. Chair?
I couldn't hear you. What did you say?
Oh, I didn't cut ahead of anybody, did I?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay. Mr. Galvin, let me ask you a question that I can't avoid asking. When Great Bear came up here while you were still Commissioner of Revenue, was that 2009 or so?
No, 2010.
2010.
So I was Commissioner of Revenue for about a month after Great Bear first came in.
Yeah, I remember the gentleman from New York coming up saying you have possibly some of the best shale, one of the best shale plays in the country. He talked about how great it was, it was all very optimistic, and I think we all sat around the table thinking, wow, this will be great, but we're in 2016 now, and we've just been paying tax credits, and tell me that the presentation to us wasn't overly optimistic. I mean, it's now many years of tax credits we've been paying.
So, Representative Garrett, through the chair, I'm sorry you weren't here for the earlier part of the presentation. I've covered the fact that Great Bear started out looking at a shale play. And what we soon realized was that the shale play was not going to be economic without the conventional. We have invested about $80 million of our money to get $220 million of exploration information, seismic, and so forth. We're right now able to use that seismic data to identify the conventional plays that we believe will be economically producible, but it still will require a significant amount of risk capital to explore that and determine whether or not that's the case. The tax credits have, I would say, been a overwhelming catalyst to the amount of activity we've been able to achieve and to advance the state's interest in developing that acreage, which had for decades gone unexplored. We had in our entire acreage positions of almost 600,000 acres, there were only 11 exploration wells prior to Great Bear.
Representative Garrett.
And no 3D seismic.
Through the chair, do you have any realistic assessment of how many barrels a day we may get out of this if it succeeds?
I think realistic is a term. Let me put it this way. We have tremendous confidence that there is a huge, overwhelming amount of hydrocarbons within our acreage. The question is, are we going to be able to find it in the type of rock that will facilitate economic development? And that has a number of different variables that we just don't know at this point. And you won't know until you actually drill the wells and evaluate the way that the oil will flow. We remain very optimistic that we will be able to produce significant amounts of oil from our acreage. We just have to do a lot more work to determine if that's going to be the case.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but when your company invests, you look for something that produces a positive net present value, not a negative net present value. at certain prices, if this project goes ahead, we get essentially no production tax up to about $73 a barrel. We'll get a royalty because you'll probably be a gross value reduction field, unless I'm wrong. But would you have any problem, so that we can protect our purse at the same time, with a tax that's a little bit better than no production tax up to $73 a barrel, knowing that you can apply for royalty relief? And you know how royalty relief works. If you show that with the existing tax structure, your field and heavy oil and shale plays may very well fit very well in the royalty relief statute because of their cost, you can then come in and say, yes, that's the tax structure, but we need a royalty break to move it forward that way. Would that seem fair to you?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I accept the premise that the state needs a return on any production. What I would suggest is that statements like we won't get any money back up to $73 is a little overly simplistic, that there is a number of different variables, including both what the cost of production is going to be, the amount of capital it's going to take to develop it, that are built into that number that you're giving that are likely not going to be an accurate picture. And secondly, if it's not profitable to produce, then it won't be produced, meaning that when you say that at $30 oil, the state's going to be giving out all these tax credits and not getting any money back, the truth of the matter is at $30 oil, it's not going to be produced. There's not going to be any investment. And so you have to look at the sort of a – you can't hold single variables fixed and then say it's going to apply to a wide range of potential prices. So I accept and agree with the objective that the state needs to have a positive NPV, as it were, for future production. But you have to look at it from all potential both variable costs and outcomes.
Captain Aguirre?
Sure. The $73 estimate of no production taxes from GBR fields is an estimate. They're not a different fields, that number will be a little bit different. I understand that. The question is, the GVR tax is quite generous to companies. Would you have a problem with some sort of modest tax change there, knowing that if the tax change in your circumstance or a heavy oil circumstance is too high, you can come in like the last three companies to get royalty relief have and say, we need royalty relief, you know, maybe at lower prices to make this project economic? Would that seem like a fair approach for you?
Well, Representative Garrett, the way that the system works is I don't get to negotiate a tax rate with you. You're going to set the tax rate and the tax policy as you feel is appropriate, and then we're going to go out and explore, determine how much production we're going to be able to get at what cost, and then run the economics and make a decision on whether or not it's worth investing in. And depending upon where you set the tax policy, that will have an impact on whether we've met a hurdle or not. If we come in close to it, then we can come in for royalty relief or some other form of getting us from uneconomic to economic. But when you're looking at your decision in terms of setting where that tax policy should be, from an explorer's perspective, all you're doing is setting my hurdle. What is it going to take for me to discover in order for it to be economic? And if you want to make it higher, then it's just going to make it that much more difficult for me to meet it with the discoveries that I make. And just to be clear, much of our acreage has a 16 2/3 royalty, and so I don't believe we would have that, the GVR.
Representative Garrett? Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Galvin, sometimes the questions we ask are with an eye towards the folks back home, so I'm going to ask a question I've heard sometimes expressed. In light of the comment on slide 11 about inertia and momentum being important in the industry, can you answer the charge that if oil requires a tax credit to be developed, it's uneconomic, and we should just leave it in the ground, and that it'll get developed eventually when there is a profit to be made? I've heard that argument a couple times.
I guess that's a valid position in terms of saying that we would rather not see the revenue associated with oil production. I think I remember back when I first came to the state back in the early 90s, and as we went into the 98, there was a lot of discussion of why don't we just turn off Trans-Alaska Pipeline during these low oil prices. I think there are some who will always say we shouldn't be investing at a particular time. But from my perspective, I think it's important for the state to make prudent investments throughout the normal price cycle that we go through, that we need to keep exploration going even in price challenged times in order to be able to have the production when the prices are higher. And as I said earlier, and I think you hear a number of people say, you can't take the economics of today and say we should make our investment decision based upon that. If that's the case, then there would be literally no investment in oil and gas going on right now. We're making the investment decisions today based upon our expectations of what the price environment's going to be 3, 4, 5, 6 plus years from now. And so from the tax credit perspective, it is an investment, particularly as far as exploration is concerned. It's an investment by the state, and it's an important investment to be made throughout the entire price cycle that oil goes through.
Thank you. To the chair, another question. To follow up on the line of questioning Representative Wilson was asking the gentleman from Fury, did Great Bear understand the risks that the exploration credits were subject to appropriation?
Yes, and I personally have a different memory of that statute when it was written and the intent of it, and that probably informed our decision that going forward that the expectation was that the placeholder, as it related to the percentage of production tax that would go into the fund, was literally that. It was a placeholder simply to keep funds moving into the fund so that the annual appropriation process could be done in order to estimate more accurately in more timely manner how much would need to be put into the fund in order to meet all of the expected credit obligations of the state. It was never intended to be either a floor or a ceiling. It was simply the beginning point of the appropriations process.
Follow up on that, Adler. Expand on that, if you would. What gave you that, on what evidence do you base that assumption or conclusion?
Well, Representative Sandler, through the chair, I was there when it was written. I asked my admin services director and my deputy commissioner to come up with a number that would roughly estimate what we would need in order to keep the fund moving, and they sort of, without any modeling or anything, came up with the figure that's in the statute.
Without any modeling, okay. Follow up. What's your opinion on the proposal by the administration to have ADA, again, have a loan program, kind of following up on that question, as an alternative to the tax credits? You touched on that a little bit, but I'd just like to hear it again.
Sure. I think it's important, again, to recognize where that loan program would fit in the evolution of oil production. You cannot have a loan program during the exploration phase. There's nothing to loan against. And so, and in addition, having a loan program, having the state say, oh, well, we don't care about whether or not you're successful or not, we'll just loan you money anyway, is basically the equivalent of almost a grant as well. You have to decide up front, is the state going to take a risked position in the exploration or not? The tax credits were designed to be the state taking a risk position and accepting the chance that it would not get paid back through future production tax and future royalty. Now, as you have a project moving towards actual development, through development, then you have potential cash flow that you can anticipate, that you can build a capital structure on. Now, what I would suggest is that at that point in the process, the state may not be as valuable as a participant because you have commercial lenders who are willing to come in and provide that capital. There may be a point, and I think this is where the program may be envisioned, there may be projects that are economically struggling in order to get past their own internal hurdles to be a sound investment that would need ADA or someone to come in with a lower interest loan in order to make that project basically get from a red light to a green light. But other than those particular projects, it's a question as to who is ADA replacing in the capital structure. If they're simply coming in to replace a commercial bank, then they're not providing any value in terms of making a project go from a red light to a green light. So they got to find that role.
Final question
then,
what will the House Resources CS version of the bill do that the governor's version would not allow your company to do?
Currently, it has little impact on us other than the fact that it doesn't include an extension of the Exploration Incentive Credit Program. But right now, the way that the bill is structured, we do not see it having a significant impact on our activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. A real short question, Representative Wilson.
Yes, it is. And thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said you helped write the legislation that said that was going to be a starting point as far as paying tax credits. So how do you justify $850 million in tax credits being paid on time, as you guys want to say it is, although we see it differently, to our constituents when, in reality, the tax credits are still good? We're going to make good on them, just not this year. But did you see that being a point in time when you wrote that we would be in a place we are right now?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I don't think anybody expected us to be at the point where we are right now. However, I testified a number of times that the way that the structure was created was the expectation that at times when the state was getting surplus, we would put that away in order to be able to cover our obligations at times when we would be in a deficit. And the way that the tax credits were viewed throughout was similar to any of our other obligations, was that we would be making those payments on a timely manner and we would build our budgets accordingly. And that's why, in fact, the appropriation bill was written the way that it was at the time, which was that it was an open-ended appropriation. Basically, the Department of Revenue had the authority to pay the tax credits that were provided, and the number was simply an estimate of what it was expected to be. The appropriation, fact, frankly, has always been that up until last year when the governor vetoed that language. This legislature passed that language, recognizing that those were obligations that needed to be paid by the state in a timely manner when they were submitted by the companies. And so it is a significant departure from anything that the state has previously done when the governor vetoed that, and it created a significant capital crisis for a number of companies.
I think, Mr. Chair, just reflects we're in a different time, and timely is probably defined differently by us than it is you.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. We've been a little over an hour and a half on the first two presentations. We have less than an hour left for the next two presentations, so we'll move on. Thank you, Mr. Galvin. And next up we have Bluecrest Energy, Mr. Benjamin Johnson, President and CEO of Bluecrest. Mr. Johnson, place yourself on the record and we'll hear your presentation. And you heard the restrictions we have on time, so I appreciate brevity if we can.
Correct.
Southwest.
There we go. Place yourself on the record, Mr. John.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Thompson and Newman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this very important issue of proposed changes to Alaska's oil and gas tax laws. For the record, my name is J. Benjamin Johnson. I'm the president and CEO of Blue Crest Energy, Inc. Now, although Blue Crest is currently based in Texas, we definitely have Alaskan roots. My family first moved to Anchor Point in the early 1950s. I grew up in Kenai, graduated from Kenai Central High. I worked my way through college on Cook Inlet platforms on the North Slope at Prudhoe. And then after college, I came back and I worked for ARCO, doing some of the early engineering work on Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk back in the early days, right after startup of the pipeline. In total, Blue Crest senior management has more than 40 years collective experience working in Alaska's oil and gas industry. John Martinek, for example, our chief operating officer, who is also a former ARCO executive, has been active in Alaska oil and gas for the past 10 years. Steve Massey, our Alaska vice president of operations, was previously ARCO's Prudhoe Bay operations manager, was E&I's senior executive in Alaska prior to joining Blue Crest. Rob McKee, who is a Blue Crest shareholder and a director of our company, was previously ConocoPhillips executive vice president for all worldwide exploration and development production, and he was directly involved in management of their Alaska operations. Well, since Blue Crest only has operations in the Cook Inlet this time, I'm only going to speak to those issues particular to the Cook Inlet. First, I want to emphasize that the state's investment through its tax credit program has facilitated our success at Cosmopolitan, which we're now moving into first production. I want to emphasize that specifically with regard to what Blue Crest is doing in the Cook Inlet, the tax credit program is definitely a very good investment for the state. Now, Blue Crest has not been involved in drilling Wildcat exploratory wells. We have focused on low-risk development of previously identified resources of oil and gas. In the process of delineating the field in 2013, we discovered several new oil and gas zones that added to the total reserves, but the underlying basis of the oil and gas accumulation was already known at the time. The bottom line is that the state's investment in development of known reserves has a much lower risk factor than support for higher risk exploratory drilling. However, if we don't do exploratory drilling now, we'll never be able to get to the low risk development drilling in the future. Blue Crest's original development plan was to find some oil and gas properties with already identified reserves that could potentially be improved using our backgrounds and knowledge of the industry. We evaluated dozens of opportunities around the U.S., And Alaska's huge handicap was, and it continues to be, that the exploration and development costs in the state are at least 300% of any other major hydrocarbon basin in the U.S. But we, Blue Crest, ultimately decided to invest in Alaska because through the credit programs, the state was investing in itself, was essentially co-investing with us. And that investment, the state's credits, somewhat offset the higher cost of drilling and development. Second, the state's investment in Cosmopolitan in particular through the credit program will provide significant future positive value to the state, even at low prices. Blue Crest is in Alaska today directly as a result of the state's incentive programs, and it's the state's investment through the tax credits that has facilitated success at Cosmopolitan. And as I'm going to demonstrate today, these credits will provide substantial future positive value to the state. I'm going to show you that the state's investment in the Cosmopolitan tax credits will provide high returns even at low oil prices. In fact, the tax credit investments under the current laws can actually provide higher rates of return to the state than the average investments in the permanent fund. And third, I'll address some specific issues with regard to the current bill and the CS. The Cosmopolitan unit itself is located about 3 miles offshore in the Cook Inlet, a few miles north of Anchor Point. All of the productive area in the unit is on state leases. We also have an onshore surface lease that contains the production facilities and the drill sites for drilling wells out to the offshore leases. For the interest of time, I'm not going to repeat my prior testimony to House Resources concerning the lengthy Cosmo history, but suffice it to say that the field was originally discovered in 1967. BlueQuest acquired the leases in 2012. We drilled a critical well in 2013, and we gained new information that has allowed us to finally develop the field, employing technology currently available today. The Cosmopolitan unit actually consists of two separate development projects. Now, we're now proceeding with development of the oil zones from onshore, but the offshore gas development is on hold due to economic limitations on cost and confirmation of sufficient market demand for the gas. The Cosmopolitan gas zones are simply too shallow to make drilling from onshore practical, so the gas zones will need to be developed by drilling gas wells offshore with a jackup rig and setting small dry gas production platforms over the wells. This is, of course, quite expensive, very expensive. The Cook Inlet gas market is quite unique in that the limited current demand for the gas without having some larger user like Agrium doesn't facilitate development of large new gas fields like Cosmopolitan to spend all the money to get it on production and then have to shut it in when we don't have a market for it. It's important to understand that although we know there is a large quantity of gas, it will take several years, however, to get it developed. And we are faced with another particular challenge in the Cook Inlet in that the one currently available drilling rig that we could use offshore to drill can't afford to stay in Cook Inlet indefinitely if we're not drilling with it in the future. And once that rig leaves, it's going to be very difficult and even maybe prohibitively expensive to bring another rig into the Cook Inlet in the future. But we are developing the oil now, and with regard to that, given the success of our 2013 drilling program, we were then faced with the challenge of how do we pay for this. Right now, BlueQuest is a small private company with a singular focus of developing the Cosmopolitan unit. Now, although the members of our management team have a lot of experience developing, designing and developing projects like this, the potential cost of doing this project far exceeded our personal financial capabilities. So we teamed up with a group of oil industry investors who have much greater financial capability than we do, and we, together with them, very carefully planned how we were going to finance development of Cosmopolitan. Now, I'd like to digress for just a minute to explain something that's really important to understand about oil and gas developments. This next chart figuratively shows the cumulative cash flow over time for a typical life cycle of a successful oil and gas development. Now, when the curve goes down, it means that the company is spending more cash in a month than it's bringing in. So when it's pointing down, we're spending more than we're bringing in. When the curve is rising, it means that the company is receiving more revenues than it is spending. But as long as the curve is below the horizontal axis here, it means that the company has cumulatively spent more money than had it received on the project. When the curve, hopefully, eventually goes above the axis, that's when the company finally begins to receive a return on its investment. There can be no profits whatsoever until the curve is all the way above the axis. That means positive cash flows for some time to get to that point. And prudent oil or gas developers will never begin a project unless they believe that it will eventually provide enough future revenues to justify the large upfront expenditures. Now, what's important to note about this chart is that the successful development of a new oil or gas field is a very, very long process. In Cosmopolitan's case, it's been almost 50 years since the original well was discovered. And it requires a lot of money to be spent before any profits can be generated at all. Now, you can see that the very first stage is spending money to explore. And at this stage, there's no assurance that anything will be found. It would be great if we could go, yeah, we know that we've got something out there and we're going to drill an exploration well. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. There's no assurance that we're going to see anything. The only way to know if an area is going to be productive is to spend lots of money to drill expensive wells and then test it. if it looks like there may be some potential. The vast majority of exploration prospects are, in fact, dry holes. That's the way the business works. The money spent will never be recovered on those dry holes. Just because you drill a lot of wells doesn't guarantee you're going to discover anything. But in the minority situation where you do, where the exploration is successful, then the really huge cost of developing the field comes into play. In many other basins around the world, producers can just simply set up a tank and turn an oil well on and vent gas to the atmosphere. Alaska is certainly not like that. I mean, Blue Crest takes a very, very strong stance on safety and protecting the environment, and it takes a lot of money to do it right. Before we can sell the first barrel of oil, we have to have all of our production facilities built. We've been working on ours at Cosmo for over 2 years now. And everything has to be spent up front before we can produce the first barrel of oil. So you can see then that after the discoveries have been made, the curve starts to go very, very negative. Now, whenever this curve goes lower, we got to come out of pocket for more. In our case, developing Cosmo, we expect that we will have to spend about $525 million to get to that point, that initial self-sustaining point, where we're actually generating more money in a month than we are spending, so we don't have to keep borrowing more money. And it will have taken decades to get to that point. What a lot of people get confused with is at the bottom of this curve where it starts to point up. This simply means that the project is generating more money on a monthly basis than we're putting into it. It doesn't mean that any profits have been generated yet. Those profits don't occur until you've gotten all of your investments back. And to further complicate the issue here, we have to consider that this curve represents development of a successful exploration program. In fact, over 2/3 to 90% of exploratory projects around the world do not find oil or gas. So for the industry to survive, we have to at least be able to generate enough profits on the successful developments to pay for the losses on the exploration side of it. So let's talk specifically about Cosmopolitan. Right now, we are days away from the very first commercial production of oil in the field. You see some pictures of what we've got going out here. Next, we're bringing in our specialized drilling rig and start spending over $40 million per well to bring on the new production that will finally start paying off our loan. That's the objective anyway. And that new drilling cannot begin until the second half of this year. Now, these photos show the progress we've made so far. The total site is 38 acres. It contains drill sites for up to 20 wells and the facilities to process approximately 10,000 barrels a day now. The site includes a 50-person camp for housing our operation workers, and we're already connected into the NSTAR gas line for selling, delivering the gas in the South Central gas supply. We're also designed to allow expansion as needed to facilitate additional production increases in the future as we drill more wells. We're almost complete in our construction process, and we're right now, today, running the final operational test of all the components, and we are on schedule for starting up this month on that. So let's look at what the tax credits from a successful development project like Cosmopolitan actually mean to Alaska. When the tax credits are used for development of new proven reserves in the state, they are, without question, a valuable low-risk investment. Speaking of the credits as a cost or a giveaway in this situation completely ignores the value that's received by the state. The tax credits make new projects work, and they bring new sources of long-term revenue for the state for decades into the future. Now, at Cosmo, we're sitting on a large proven resource of future oil and gas. We know it's there. It simply requires drilling and spending additional new investments to bring it on production. On February 19th, the DOR provided its analysis of the financial impact to the state on development of a typical new Cook Inlet oil field, not Cosmo, but somewhat close, assuming that no changes are ever made to the existing tax laws, including the tax credits and production tax rates. DOR's analysis modeled an example Cook Inlet field that's somewhat, it's more expensive and less productive than the actual Cosmopolitan oil development. So the DOR's calculations are, in fact, somewhat conservative. This chart is a summary of the calculations that DOR provided. It shows the total net benefit received by the state and municipalities, including, in this case, taxes and royalties, as a function of various future oil prices. It shows that even if oil prices over the entire field life average only $35 a barrel, the state would break even. In other words, the state would receive back 100% of its investments in the tax credits, unchanged from current law, for many years into the future. At about $47 a barrel, the average oil price, the state would receive back double the amount of its investment, and at $59 per barrel, the state would receive back triple its investment in the oil tax credits. The DOR also provided their calculations showing the impact of the tax credits as a pure investment, with a head-to-head comparison to the investments by the permanent fund. According to DOR, the permanent fund's September 2015 earnings were 6.15%. So if an alternative investment earned less than 6.15%, it would have had a worse performance than the average investment in the permanent fund. On the other hand, if it earned more than that, it would be a better investment than what the permanent fund had in place in September 2015. This chart shows that even in the case where there are never any changes to the tax system in the Cook Inlet, that is, all the tax credits stay the same, there are no taxes until 2022 on oil, the state's investment in those credits for this example field is still better than the average investment in the permanent fund as long as oil prices over the next 30 years average only $44 a barrel. Now I'd like to provide our additional comments on particular portions of this bill specific to Bluecrest and the Cosmopolitan. First of all, termination of the 023A and L credits, the A is qualified capital expenditure and the L is well lease expenditure, we call those. Termination of those would result in a significant reduction in our ability to continue making investments in the field, resulting, of course, in less future revenues to the state. The governor's original bill completely eliminated the well lease expenditure credits, effective immediately. The House Resources CS temporarily retained that credit, but effectively scaled it down to 20% over a two-year period of time, and then reduced the NOL credit from 40% from 25% down to 10% at the time. So Bluecrest has actually, we've done our own individual analysis on this as well, showing the results for Cosmopolitan. The numbers, the charts we had before were DOR's calculations on a typical Cook Inlet project that was similar to Cosmo. This is an example calculation for Cosmo wells, new drilling. So we've done some interesting analysis here. In the impact of keeping those full credits in place as they would apply to Cosmopolitan, we looked at the effective return using just a simple and conservative calculation assuming only the incremental royalty that the state would receive. So we didn't include any taxes of any kind. This calculation doesn't even include anything that would be like the property taxes and the production taxes after 2022. The bottom line here is that in periods of low oil prices, these credits allow us to continue drilling Cosmopolitan oil wells at about $10 a barrel lower oil price than without the credits. I mean, if oil prices are really high, we're going to be drilling these wells anyway. But where they really come into play, what makes a difference is at low prices, these credits amount to a benefit of about $10 a barrel encourage us to invest the money to drill. This next chart then shows the calculated return on investment to the state, including only the royalties again, from these credits. 100% return on investment shown on this chart, the bottom of the chart, means that 100% of the tax credit would be repaid out of increased royalty over the life of the well at an average oil price of only $24 a barrel. At $40 a barrel, the total return would be 170%, and at $60 a barrel, that return is about 250%. So you can see that these credits, at least for this particular situation in Cosmopolitan, are a very good investment for the state here. Now, another factor in the original bill was setting a limitation as to the amount of the credits that can be paid out annually. Now, while the CS provided for a larger limit that probably actually wouldn't affect Bluecrest, it still doesn't recognize the differences in qualified investments made by the different parties. If this limit is too low, it would be particularly damaging to small companies like Bluecrest who've already invested in good faith based on the tax policy in existence when we entered into the commitments for these investments. I mean, we came to Alaska based on these credits. There was no indication the law was changing. We invested our cash, and we borrowed a lot of money and committed to spending a lot more based on these tax credits. And the timing of the receipt of these payments is also paramount to our ability to make the payments on the loan used for making these investments. So this chart shows our sources of money for paying that $525 million. So the most important of any of these provisions is the timing of implementation of changes to us, whatever they may be. Here it is now, April, and the proposed changes in the original 247, HB 247, are supposed to take place on July 1st. The CS moved that date back, which certainly helped, but it doesn't completely solve the problem. Bluecrest has been, as I mentioned, very careful in our planning process. Before we ever started the oil development project, before we made the first dollar of investment in the development, we made sure that we'd have enough funds to allow us to complete construction of the onshore drill site, production facilities, bring in the most powerful drilling rig in Alaska, and to drill at least the first two new wells. We calculated that this $525 million would be needed to reach the point of self-sufficiency. And we expect that should happen in the first half of 2017. In order to make that work, our shareholders invested approximately $200 million in cash. We borrowed $30 million from ADA for a loan on the drilling rig, just kind of like a car loan. It's a drilling rig loan. And then we secured a $150 million loan, a fairly high interest development loan. And then the balance, we have received $24 million to date in tax credits. Okay, so we'll be happy to tell you that. And the remaining $121 million was to come from the credits earned for spending in 2015 and 16 under the current laws. We've spent a lot of money to get to the point where we can now start drilling these new wells, but an abrupt termination of the credits, which we based our entire financial planning on, would just be devastating to us if they went away right away. Now, we finally reached the point by completing all this work, spending all this money, to where we finally will have everything ready to drill in the second half of 2016 and the first quarter of 17. So we need the production from these first new wells to pay for the costs we've spent so far. These drilling costs, at least through early 2017, are all based on the assumption that we'll be able to obtain the credits under existing law for these investments. We've done all this work, and we've spent all this money to date, and it seems only reasonable for us to be able to claim the credits for the spending that is the result of our investments made in good faith based on the expectation that the state would honor its share of those investments as at the time we made the investments, we committed to it. We need to be able to get to the finish line. Here is the bottom line. If the date changes in the original bill, back to the original bill, just 3 months from now, if that was reinstated, we wouldn't have the full funding for finishing the initial part of this project. Although we basically already committed to those investments. I've signed contracts. We've brought people in. So not paying those credits that were the basis for those investments is kind of like saying, well, you can spend all your money for a house, but you can never move into it. I mean, we're that close. We're really close to the finish line here. And in the bottom line, in conclusion, I'd just like to reemphasize the importance of phasing into any changes that are to be made over some reasonable time period. Everyone in this room today understands that when we're driving on slippery, icy roads, the most dangerous thing we can do is to slam on the brakes. And we're encouraging you to be cautious in that timing. We appreciate your consideration of these issues, and be happy to take any questions.
All
All right. Questions, Mr. Johnson, and please be aware of the shortness of time. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So help me understand, are you talking about the change in tax credits, the percentages of them, or are you talking about the payment in cash because you've already qualified for the tax credits?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it's firstly being paid for the credits that we've earned to date, but that we will also earn through the end of this year, early into next year. Because those investments were made based upon the law that is currently in place today. Going beyond that point, we'll decide whether we can invest whatever the law is at that point.
Okay, to follow up?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, we didn't change the law. Okay, the expectation was there right now as far as we've been in the past paying the credits as they came in. But the law did not state that we had to do that. We did it because, back to the production taxes we were getting, were much higher than what they are now. And so, therefore, the math worked out. Now the math doesn't work out. So I'm really getting tired of hearing that we're not honoring our, commitments, because that's just not true. Yes, right now, because production tax is not where it is, those credits are still good. We're still, as far as I plan, on honoring them. So there is a distinction. So even if they were put out a year or 2 years on paying them, what would that have, with your development?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it would have a major impact to us, at least on the short term here, because we have requirements to pay our loan in a certain amount of time. So we need those credits at least through 2017, paying for 2016 spendings. Beyond that point, if I don't know how big the credits may or may not be there, but the timing of that we can deal with. Now, I do understand, I hear what you're saying, and I know this, that the law did not require the payment of over a certain amount. However, it has certainly been the practice of the state to do that. And we were originally, I'll tell you how we got started. We originally met a group from the state of Alaska down in Houston, and they had a program called Dispelling the Great Alaska Fear Factor, and talked about the tax credits, and there was no mention that the credits would not be paid in full, but and the practice has been that they always have been. But what I'm saying is that at least for the short time here, it's important that we receive the full payment. I mean, we're not talking about a huge dollar amount, but it is important that we would receive those timely.
And finally, Mr. Chair.
Shortly, please.
Yes. We are looking to pay for them, so we're still going to do that. Is $121 million what you believe you're owed by the end of this year?
We have, somewhere in that ballpark. That's really a combination of all the money that would be paid in 2016 and then the money that would be paid again in 2017 for 2016 spending. That's what that is.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. And keep in mind that we have one more presenter, and in fairness to them, please keep it as short as we can.
Thank you. I'll try to limit it to two questions. you understand that the main purpose of the Cook Inlet tax credits, or the Cook Inlet tax rate, which is essentially zero, was to get local natural gas, and we're paying these tax credits for oil. What would be your reaction if we said on oil at some point we need some sort of fair production tax, because right now it's zero in Cook Inlet?
Well, Representative Guerra, through the chair, we will respond if there is a tax on oil. We'll certainly pay it, and we will have to roll that into our planning for future drilling. That's just a function of the future.
Through the chair.
Garrett.
And then we all find it hard to believe that nobody knew about the limit that we're required to pay on tax credits based on the amount of production tax we get in a year. But even assuming you didn't know that in 2015, you knew it in 2016, right? We had a big debate in this legislature about whether we should limit our payments to the statutory amount, to something more than that, to something less than all of those that were due. That was a big debate in 2015, and you made your investments in 2016 knowing that, right?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we committed to this spending throughout 2016 in basically early 2015. So this was before the governor's veto. All of this planning and the work was done prior to that point in time. Now, at this point, we understand that there could be changes, and we'll adjust to that. All I'm saying is that over the next year or two, it's important that we receive hopefully the full amount, or close to the full amount that we would be owed on these.
Can I continue on with the next presenter? Thank you, Mr. Johnson, very much. I apologize for the shortness of time here. Aetna is our next presenter. We have Mr. Chris Cook, the Director of Finance, and to answer questions if necessary is Matt Block, the General Counsel. All right, gentlemen, place yourselves on the record, and we'll hear your presentation. I apologize that we've kind of condensed your time, but we do have to gavel out at 11 a.m., so please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, my name is Matt Block, and I'm the general counsel for Aetna, Inc. With me is Chris Cook, our director of finance, who will be presenting. Joe Bovey, our land manager, and Roy Tanzi, executive vice president of our subsidiary holding company, Aetna Natiat, couldn't be here. They previously testified on this, and they regret that they could not be here to testify. I'll confess I'm a bit of a last-minute substitution. So fortunately, we have Chris, who's knowledgeable and very, very smart, and he'll be doing the presentation. But just to correct the record, it's unlikely I'll be answering any questions, at least intelligently. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the committee and the chair, for allowing us to be here to testify on the Frontier Basin's tax credits. This tax credit program in particular is critically important to Aetna and to what we're doing in our region. As the committee is aware, the benefits of gas exploration and oil exploration are not just financial, although there are financial benefits to the state and to others. In our region, the cost of energy, and generally speaking, the cost of energy in the rural areas is very, very high. And the benefit of gas exploration in the region is we stand a chance, no guarantees, we stand a chance of reducing the cost of rural energy delivery. These Frontier Basin tax credits are make it, break it for us. This year, Aetna is moving forward, as Chris will discuss, with a gas exploration program. Who knows, maybe an oil exploration program. We would not be moving forward with that program if not for these tax credits. It is that black and white. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Chris to present on these very important tax credits on.
Thank you for letting us be here. This is Chris Cook, Director of Finance with Aetna. Aetna is certainly utilizing these credits. We're using these credits for risk mitigation. We wouldn't be doing our exploration program in the Copper River Basin without the credits. And there is upside for the state through royalties and through lower rural energy costs. The Frontier Basin credits have been around since 2002. They were intended to incentivize oil and gas exploration in underexplored basins. They reduce the risk of development in local rural areas such as the Copper River Basin. That area hasn't seen exploration for some time. They're intended to create a local energy source for rural residents, and it's anticipated that it could reduce or eliminate power cost equalization in the area. The exploration credits that Aetna is currently utilizing is the 025A6. And that provides for two exploration wells drilled in each Frontier Basin, and the credit is up to 80% or $25 million of qualified expenditures. The other credit that Autnet is currently utilizing is the 025A7, and that covers the seismic, our seismic program in that area. And it's up to 75% credit for up to $77.5 million. And again, Autnet would not be doing any exploration in that area without these credits. Autnet has gone through pre-qualification with the state Division of Oil and Gas for the seismic work and the well. We've had the state review our seismic data, and they have approved the well for 025 credits. We had the target that we're currently drilling or will be drilling here shortly is away from the previous exploration targets that have been drilled in that area. And we will be required to release the data after 2 years after the exploration program. And the well is intended for the local energy needs of the area. I'm going to go pretty quickly through this slide. So Autnet has been pursuing since 2012 our exploration program, and we've processed our seismic, and we've identified some targets in that area, some of them which are on Autnet land and some which are on state land. And the well that we're drilling here in the next several months will be on state land. Thank you. Let's see here. There it goes. Here's a map of the Copper River Basin, and I believe the red shows Autnet land, and I believe the purple is state land. I'm not sure about the yellow land. But our proposed well is about 4,500 vertical feet. We're targeting the Nelchina sandstone, where there's been previous gas shows on other wells in the area. There's been 11 wells drilled in that area since the 1960s. And the most recent well was by our partner Rudder in 2005 and 2008. And there were natural gas shows in that well. It's a Solana number one well that we're drilling is a great potential for a local fuel source for the Copper River Basin. The benefits that we're looking to get are opportunities for local employment, economic benefits by having lower energy for the local community, and reducing the out-migration. There's a lot of folks who are moving away from rural areas of Alaska due to the high energy costs. And we'd like to build infrastructure in that area. Here's a map of the exploration play. It's about 10 miles heading towards Anchorage outside of Glen Allen. And if it's successful, we'll be looking to we'll be paying royalties and production tax. We're hiring locally in Alaska. We're working with Autnet Construction is putting in our pad right now. HXR Drilling Services is providing our drilling engineering and some of the management. Our Restoration Science and Engineering, a local company, has worked with us for the permitting, and we're working with many Alaskan companies. We've had great agency support. Our DNR, Division of Oil and Gas Director, has visited the region and the project site. Here's a timeline, and we are bumping up against the expiration of the Frontier Basin credits, and we are asking for those to get extended to 2022, similar to the 023 credits. So our request is that 025A, 6, and 7 credits be extended to 2022 to coincide with other credits. We're looking for follow-on wells in that area for our exploration program. And this and the Frontier Basin Credit incentivizes the development, the exploration and development of energy in that area. Some of the follow-on wells will not be under the Frontier Basin Credit, so we also support the extension, or I guess the continuation of 023, the Middle Earth Credits, as they will also incentivize exploration and development in that area. Is there any questions from the
questions
from the committee?
To Mr. Cook or Mr. Block, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just using your timetable you have, that looks like goes to 2016. Why the extension to 2022? Is there other projects that's not on this chart?
That's correct. There are additional targets in that area that we're looking at.
And follow up?
Representative Wilson.
And do you have any, and I'm assuming you're doing mostly gas, do you have any idea what you think there might be there as far as being able to take care of this area?
The target that we're drilling right now, if there's gas there, it'll be commercial for that area.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson. All right. Further questions from the committee?
Yes, sir.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may not know this. most of the companies who are paying tax credits to for gas are paying the state no production taxes, even if these fields come online. I can't remember for this part of the state. Is that the same rule, or after we pay you our tax credits, do you pay a production tax?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I'm unclear on that, too. My understanding, I believe, is we'd pay production taxes. I need to check on that. And if I could clarify that, too. If there's gas there, there's the potential for that to be commercial in the area. You never know until you drill your delineation wells.
If I remember right, there is a provisions in there for production tax once they begin producing. It did have a couple of few years to try to recover their investments. So it was a reduced amount, but there is production tax. Continue, Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to take up the committee's time.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Very briefly, through the chair, sir, is there any obviously the clear market for your drilling is the interior market. Is there any formal commitment or informal understanding about who will be ultimate purchaser of any gas you find and produce?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we do not have commercial agreements in place. I guess the plan is to identify prove up resources and see how large of a resource there is to supply the local community. But this, I mean, I guess the bullseye on this particular well is, the intent is to supply energy for the local community.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, Mr. Block and Mr. Cook, thank you very much for your presentations. Also presenting today was supposed to be Doyon. Both of the presenters are sick with the flu, and they couldn't be here. So we will be getting their testimony to you when we receive it. And that is going to conclude our presentations for the day. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for today, Monday, March 4th, at 1:30 p.m., and we will have a confirmation hearing for Lorraine Durr, Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees, and we will hear House Bill 254, Extend Big Game Commercial Services Board, House Bill 156, School Accountability Measures, Federal Law, House Bill 206, Water and Sewer Advisory Committee. And with that, at 10:50 a.m., we are adjourned.